Welcome to the fourth and final Orca Month Book Club video podcast episode. If you've joined us before, we have been reading three books: Orca, The Whale Called Killer by Eric Hoyt, Listening to Whales by Alexandra Morton, and Endangered Orcas, The Story of the Southern Residents by Monica Whelan Shields. And in the previous three episodes, we have interviewed all three authors. And now on this final episode, we will be chatting. That's myself, Whitney Negebauer, and Colleen Weiler, the Jessica Rikos Fellow with Whale and Dolphin Conservation. We will be having just a casual conversation about these books. And if you have enjoyed these, we invite you to join us throughout the summer for community discussions about the books. So in July, we will be having like a Zoom webinar discussion about Orca the Whale Called Killer. In August, we will be talking about Listening to Whales. And then in September, talking about Endangered Orcas, which is Monica's book. So check on the Orca Month Facebook page and Whale and Dolphin and Whale Scout Facebook pages, our websites. We will be posting more information about those and polling all of you on when might be a good time to all gather together. You know, this has been a part of Orca Month during the month of June, which of course, because of coronavirus, has been all virtual. So we thank you for joining us virtually and hope that we can still stay connected all throughout the summer. Colleen, it's excellent to see you today. How are you?
You too, Whitney. I'm doing well. Kind of what you just said, I do miss seeing everybody in person. I wish we could get together for in-person Orca Month events this year, but I am excited to still connect virtually. And I think taking things online has given us kind of some new opportunities. We had been talking about doing like a whale book club at WGC for a long time. So being able to join you for these Orca Month book club events has been really fun and so good to kind of revisit some of these both classic and then new books about orcas that we all really love.
So we're recording this episode on the 25th, and Orca Month is really coming to a close. But like you mentioned, you have done a lot of really cool virtual events. Do you want to share a little bit about them if people want to go back and find some of the events that you've been hosting?
Ooh, yeah. So for WDC, we did a Whalecraft Wednesday series on our Facebook page, so their Facebook Live videos, which is really fun. It was just a good way to get your creative energy out and show our theme for this month, for this year's Orca Month, was Orca Love. So creating these orca crafts to show our orca love, and then also creating them out of household items, so repurposing and upcycling things to help cut down on, you know, creating waste and use of plastic. So kind of multi-purpose activities, which was really fun. We did a happy hour series. We talked to some breweries here in the Pacific Northwest that use some fantastic sustainable brewing methods and help protect watersheds and salmon in their businesses. And we talked to everybody's favorite orca whale dog, Eva, and Dr. Giles with Conservation Canines. And of course, Orca Month Book Club, which has been super fun. And we have a movie night coming up still to do a group watch of Blackfish and kind of revisit how that movie connects to Southern residents.
Well, that sounds really cool. We've been this week sending out all of our orca conservation kits, and what those kits are.
Look amazing, Whitney.
Oh, thank you. It's been a lot of hard work. You know, we've had about over 300 native shrubs sitting in my driveway, so I've been taking care of them the best that I can, and also putting together all of these educational materials into bags and, you know, tailoring each bag for the number of kids a certain household has, putting together the plants that people have requested. We tried to have plants that were good for smaller containers and smaller yards. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's been a lot of fun and a lot of hard work. And the goal was to try to bring some of our restoration events that we typically have in large groups outside back to people's homes. And so their own backyards can be little mini restoration sites. So that's been a lot of fun. We ran out of them really quickly. So if we do them again in the near future, we will, of course, post that to our Facebook and our website. And you can go check out photos of those being delivered on our Facebook page. But yeah.
Those looked so cool. And I love the idea of bringing that habitat protection and restoration back to people's homes and making it really hands-on for them. So those are awesome. And I can't wait to claim one on the next round.
Yeah. We'll deliver it all the way to Oregon for you.
Yeah. Figure it out.
We've actually had a lot of requests for areas that are outside of our delivery range because we're depending on volunteers and interns to deliver all these kits. And people would email and say, oh, can you come down to Tumwater? Or, you know, and a lot of our volunteers said, yeah, I'll make the drive. You know, people don't have a lot to do and they want to help. So it's been fantastic.
Yeah, that's awesome. And kudos to your volunteers for being so willing to do that and jump in there. And I'm sure that, you know, we want to share the Orca love far and wide. So
absolutely,
we're going to make that go that extra mile.
Yes. And speaking of Orca love, I love these three books. These three are, you know, they have to make my top five favorite Orca books ever. I will not choose a favorite book out of these. Do you have a favorite?
Oh, well, that's not a fair question. You just said that. I would say I can't choose a favorite either, because even though, as we've talked about throughout this month, there are so many connections between these books, and they all have these really interesting, you know, themes that are present throughout. They're all kind of different in their own way. Like Alexandra's is more of a memoir about her time and her experience with the whales. Monica's really focuses on the endangered status of the southern residents and kind of how we got to this point. And Eric's, you know, Orca, the Whale Called Killer, is really kind of about the start of orca research and when researchers started figuring out all of these different communities and different ecotypes. And so they're different enough that they can be like different categories for me. So I don't think I can pick a favorite between them.
No, absolutely not. I do think, you know, the way that we decided to order these books too was Orca the Whale Called Killer sort of started in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Alexandra's work sort of brings us more in the 80s and further in time. And then Monica's book brings us even further in time, really quite literally up until the present. So you can see the evolution starting with the research in the northern resident killer whales here with Orca the Whale Called Killer and Listening to Whales. And then, of course, Monica's book focuses a lot more on southern resident killer whales, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. And then you get kind of a mix of different ecotypes with Alexandra's book, because she started with dolphins and then moved to captive orcas and then northern residents and transients and salmon. So there's kind of covers every base in her book. But yeah, and I think for the reasons you mentioned, we chose these because it kind of tracks our understanding of the whales and how that's changed. And so going back and revisiting them, it's just fascinating to see what we knew at the time the books were written and how it's updated through each one. Like Eric's is kind of, you know, the first edition came out in the 80s, and we're looking at, we still didn't know that there were offshore orcas and the whales weren't listed as endangered yet. And there's still so much that was unknown. And then Alexandra's is slightly updated, but there's still a lot of pieces that we didn't know yet. As going back and, you know, looking through hers, and she talks about, we didn't know how long orcas were pregnant or how long they nursed at that time. And, you know, so much has changed between each book, and we've learned so much between each one that it's really interesting to track the progression of knowledge through the three different books.
Another similarity is a lot of these authors, you know, they tell their personal story, and in their personal stories, they started off fairly young, inexperienced in these books, and then really grew from there. And a lot of their origin stories began with whales or dolphins in captivity, which I thought was interesting. Do you relate in any way? When you were a child, did you ever go to SeaWorld or see whales in captivity?
Yeah, I know that I went to SeaWorld. I mean, my first introduction to the world of whales, like many people in my millennial age class, was Free Willy. So I think we were kind of conditioned from seeing that movie to already think like, oh, whales should be free and captivity is maybe not the best place for them, but without really, you know, having an understanding of why. But I know I went to SeaWorld at some point after seeing Free Willy, but I have no memory of being there at all. I do remember going on whale and dolphin watches in the wild on the East Coast in Massachusetts and then down in Florida and seeing them out in the wild. But I don't remember ever seeing, I know I've been to SeaWorld, I don't remember it. So maybe I've just like blocked that memory out of my head.
I as a kid, went to SeaWorld as well. We would go down to California to visit my cousins, and you know, like going to the theme parks was just one of the things that we did. We went to Disneyland and then we went to SeaWorld, that, you know, I guess that must have been in San Diego. But yeah, we went as well. And I, like you, watched the Free Willy, well, at least the first one, Free Willy movies. And yeah, really felt like seeing them in captivity was interesting. I have photos in my scrapbooks of, you know, going to the shows. And but yeah, my mom took us as little kids to Friday Harbor. She really nurtured my obsession with orcas and took us to Friday Harbor in the summertime. And but we never saw whales. We would sit at Lime Kiln. Yeah, like we would sit at Lime Kiln for hours and hours. And I remember talking with some of the naturalists there, but we would go year after year and not see them and go on whale watching trips and be really bummed out to not see them. But I don't think it stifled my enthusiasm whatsoever.
I don't think so either, given given how you've developed Whale Scout and turned that into such a cool program. But
well, thanks.
Did it, when you did have the chance to see them in the wild, it sounds like not a lot of luck when you were a kid, but like for all of these authors, it seems to have, seeing the whales in the wild seems to have been much more impactful than seeing them in captivity and really changed their perception after having both of those experiences. So for you, once you finally got to see them in the wild, did that shift your perspective or change anything for you?
Yeah, you know, I think I do remember the first time I saw the whales in the wild, and it actually was a trip, a whale watching trip. I think we went out of Anacortes, and it was like my dad's office got together and for like a retreat, and I was able to go. And I remember distinctly, like right off the bow was J1's fin coming straight up, and I knew who he was like immediately when I saw him. That was so cool. And yeah, their size and power. And yeah, I do remember that moment and it'll stick with me for a really long time. One of the parts in the book that sticks with me the most, I think personally most connected to Alexandra Morton's book. And in the book, she talks about being with Corky. It was in captivity, and studying Corky and then eventually going up to the Johnson Strait to meet Corky's family. Mm-hmm. And she talks about, you know, returning back to see Corky in captivity after having spent the summer with her family. And the way that she writes it in the book was like, you know, she's wearing this sweater and the droplets from Corky's family are still on her sweater. Mm-hmm. And it's like the DNA is literally on her, and the guilt that she feels was really powerful to me.
Yeah, I agree. That line, and then how she goes on to talk about, especially, I think, Corky's calves and the heartbreak and sadness of, you know, those those lost babies, and then thinking about seeing her family and comparing the healthy bouncing baby calves that Corky's family was having in the wilds, and just the sadness and the guilt, and how she writes about feeling like she's failed Corky because she went to see her family and she wasn't able to help Corky reunite with them. It is heartbreaking and hard to think about. You know, that's this book was written almost 20 years ago, and that's still the situation. You know, Corky's still held in captivity and her family is still out in Johnstone Strait and in the waters off British Columbia, and we haven't made a lot of progress since then.
And if I remember correctly, you have spent some time up viewing the Northern Residence. What's that like?
it's strange. Like it's really cool. They're a very fun population to watch, but working on Southern Resident Orca Recovery and then going up and looking at Northern Residents, you do kind of feel like you're wondering, you know, how is this population doing relatively well when the Southern Residents are struggling so much? And so it's watching them with the same wonder and awe that always comes with seeing wild orcas, but also for me, like a little bit of jealousy on behalf of the Southern Residents. I'm kind of just like, hey, how is this population like doing relatively well? And the Southern Residents continue to struggle, but even, you know, being up there and seeing the different habitats that they live in is also pretty striking, because it's so remote and still looks relatively pristine up in the world of the Northern Residents. And down here, we see the Southern Residents off Seattle and in Puget Sound, and we know that they're struggling with contaminants and noisy waters. And so the difference in habitat is pretty striking as well.
Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna, like, that's maybe one of the biggest noticeable differences.
In any of these three books, is there a book or a story within a book that is, you know, really pulls at your heartstrings or that you feel a strong connection to?
I really like when all of the authors share the unusual stories. And I think probably something that happens when you just spend as much time as these authors have with the whales and out observing them and studying them, and they all have these instances that they can't really explain, you know, like with Monica's and the whale and Elpod that kind of swam up directly perpendicular to shore and was vocalizing and doing just this really weird, inexplicable behavior. And Alexandra shares the stories of the whales possibly rescuing dogs that have fallen into the water, and just the things that we don't have any reasons for, and just kind of, you know, it highlights the mystery and the wonder of these whales and how much we still don't know about their lives and how they think and what they do. So it's just, you know, you read those and you kind of get chills and you're like, oh, they're so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The theme of Orca Month this year, you mentioned, is orca love. Do you know, and we asked all of the authors of these books, like, what is it about orcas that is so powerful to you? Like, why do you love orcas? Can you pinpoint for yourself why you love orcas?
Ah, Whitney, turning it around on me.
I know.
I think I would have, I know that I have as much trouble actually pinpointing it as the authors did, because it is hard to sum it up into, you know, just a couple sentences of saying what you love about orcas. I think for me, it is how similar they really are to us. And even though there is so much that we still don't know, the more we learn, the more we kind of see the parallels to our own lives and find all of these unexpected connections with the whales. They're so, you know, obviously very intelligent. They're family oriented. They have these long lives and cultures and societies. And it's just kind of, you know, you're just awestruck by how much they are just their own community and population and whole society that's under the waves that we don't really know anything about still.
Yeah, you said the word there, because I've been trying to think about this a lot lately. And as I mentioned, as a kid, I never saw the whales. You know, it took a long time, but I read about them in books and I was fascinated through books. But there is this feeling when you see them on the water. And I think a lot of people, you hear, you know, naturalists say, oh my gosh, it's been so long since I've seen the whales. I need a whale fix, right? And there is a seeing them does give some sort of feeling. And I've been reading this book called Nature Fix, and it's about, you know, wellness and about being connected with the outdoors and how that is so good for you mentally and also physically. And it talks about this concept of awe. And I think that's what it is. People see these whales and it's awe. Mm-hmm. And being in that moment of awe, everything else sort of fades away and everything is very still. And, you know, a lot of people feel a similar way when, you know, maybe they're practicing yoga or and a runner's high when they're out jogging. And there is almost this feeling when you're watching them and you're connected to them, that's happiness, that's awe, that's, you know, balance or whatever it is. And I think a lot of people that are really deeply connected with the whales feel that feeling as well. And it's more than that too. It's about more than the feeling that you get from the whales, but it's about giving back to the whales and about helping in any way that you can and learning more about them so that you can continue their population.
Yeah, I think especially for the southern residents and seeing them, it is that awe and wonder, but with their status, as Monica writes about in her book, you kind of, you feel awe, but also a little bit of sadness understanding their situation. And I think it does though inspire people to learn what they can do to help and how they can take action and how they can be part of the recovery for the population, because it would be really nice to go back to watching them and just feel happy and joyful and peaceful and not also have that little bit of, you know, stress at the back of your head that you're like, I'm watching this population, but will I see these whales again? You know?
Yeah. I know a lot of people share the feeling of the excitement initially of hearing that, you know, southern residents are inbound. And then there's mm-hmm. that like twinge of fear, like, oh, I hope they're all there.
Yeah. Yep. That kind of nervous anxiety of, all right, let's confirm who is seen and was everybody in the family seen. And ooh, yeah, it can be stressful. Did you have any points? I mean, there's, as we've talked about, you know, there's different information kind of like our knowledge of the whales is different for each book. Was there anything in any of the books that surprised you the most of like, we thought at the time the book was written that the whales were one thing and then we learned to the next book that it was actually this other thing?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned that, you know, the whales always are surprising us. They're always, you know, you never say the whales always do something because then they'll prove you wrong like the very next moment. But one thing that I found really interesting in Monica's book, which I was surprised I didn't know about, was the different pods. And Southern residents are made up of J, K, and L pod. But we were a little bit mixed up there for a while. And that we thought that some whales are from one pod and then we had to actually reshuffle them to another pod. And I can't remember off the top of my head which ones that was. But just, you know, we had to like rename some whales, you know, even in the recent past.
Yeah, I did not know that either. And Monica's book is really cool because it does include some of the history of things that we now know, but I didn't know like the full backstory of, and that was one of them was, cause I have this big gap in my own database of, I think they're L pod whales that there's just no record of. And it, cause it turns out they were K pod whales. So they just switched them and that they, luckily the researchers figured that out early enough in the census and the research project that they could just be the same number. Like, I think it was L7. I'm sorry, I might get that wrong, but they just changed them to K-pod for like the corresponding number, which was really, I guess, serendipitous for for naming purposes.
Yeah, absolutely. And throughout the book too, all three authors use real names for the whales, which I think helps solidify that connection. And I know there's a big effort right now to also name a lot of the transient killer whales or the Biggs killer whales, to help continue that connection that we have with the whales.
Yeah, and some of the books that do mention the Biggs killer whales coming in and out, kind of, and as they were figuring out the different ecotypes, at first they named whales by those distinguishing characteristics because they were still sorting them into those ecotypes and then populations. So they had, you know, like notch and stubs, and naming them based on really identifiable things about them. So it definitely helps to highlight the personalities and the individualities of the whales.
Another thing I really liked about all three books was that they all kind of went out on a limb and mentioned, you know, the politics that surround the whales. In Eric Hoyt's book, a lot of it had to do with captures and captivity. Mm-hmm. Alexander Morton had a little bit to do with whale watching and salmon farming. And then in Monica's book, she talks a little bit about, you know, like the naming, like we were talking about, and the politics around naming the whales and around a lot of the research and the research community. How did you react to reading about some of the politics in these books?
Yeah, it's interesting how it, again, that has kind of changed over time too. And the time period that each book was written, they mention the big politics and the big issues at each time. And again, with those transition between the books, by the time Alexander's book was written, the live captures had stopped in the Pacific Northwest. Unfortunately, whale watching is still kind of a political hot topic between Alexander and Monica's book, but it's interesting how it is different between the northern and southern resident communities and in those different areas. But it is kind of, you know, you can't really talk about the whales without talking about some of those more controversial and political things. But I really admired that the authors took the time to talk about those and to take a stance on them, you know, because it can be difficult for researchers to make that transition into advocacy and talking about some of these policy issues, which we've also talked about with them. But they kind of are walking that line between doing the science and research and then also being advocates for the whales. And each of them talk about these different issues that they feel very passionate about for the conservation and protection of the whales. Like Eric talks about protecting Robson Bight as a habitat area for northern residents. Alexander talks about the development of whale watching around northern residents, and then also with the salmon farms. And Monica talks about Snake River Dam removal and other things that could help to protect and recover the southern residents. So it's really interesting to see their perspective as researchers on some of these policy and political issues.
Right. And they all come at this from using science, but they mm-hmm. feel that the science, you know, it's almost part of the larger picture of what they're trying to do. It's part of their work. Which I think is really cool. And, you know, I know a lot of people feel like it's their responsibility to be also thinking of conservation, which reminds me, I watched a webinar Orca Network put together. Our orcas are hungry, I think is what they called it. And it dealt with, you know, orcas and salmon as prey. And it had Monica Wieland Shields and Dr. Deborah Giles. And I thought Deborah Giles, we call her Giles for short, she did a really great job of explaining sort of her work in conservation biology and how the science sort of informs the policy and how the policies, as they're shifting, that the science can tell, you know, is this making a difference for the whales? And as Eric Hoyt mentioned in his video podcast episode, you know, he says, can the whales notice the difference? And that really stayed with me in everything that we do. Can the whales tell the difference that we did something?
Yeah. And that also, you know, the title of Alexander Morton's book is Listening to Whales and What They Can Teach Us. So I think there's a strong connection there too, is sometimes we can get so wrapped up in the politics of things and people, you know, on so many sides of the issue want to be right, but it really does come back to the whales and do they notice a difference and are we really listening to them to see what they need? And if what we're doing is making a change for them. And that really does rely on the conservation biology and the science and, you know, paying attention and watching these things and these issues with the whales to see if our actions are, which direction our actions are having an impact in, if it's positive or if it's negative.
Are there any lingering questions that these books leave for you? Anything that you hope that these authors or future authors might tackle?
Ooh, well, I hope that all of them have a sequel. more positive, I guess. I mean, they're all. I think they all end on optimistic notes, right? They all have these epilogues or these, you know, final chapters that wrap up with their hopes for the future and what they think could happen for these whales if humans make the right choices. So again, you know, going back to what we were just discussing with conservation and listening to the whales and is it making a difference for the whales? So I would love to see like a recap of, the southern residents were endangered, but then all these really great conservation actions happened and now they're doing great. And like, here's the story of how we saved the southern residents, or here's the story of how the northern residents became a good and healthy population. So that's what I'd like to see.
Yeah, that would be great. I would love that. I would love to hear. Yeah. And I know Alexander Morton mentioned that she's writing another book about salmon farming in BC. So we'll wait to see what that's all about. But I hope that tells a successful story of the salmon farms being taken out and the wild salmon returning healthier and stronger. Yeah, I would love to hear a book about the southern residents and how we were able to, you know, quiet the waters and reverse a lot of the habitat destruction that has happened that have led to the decline of salmon, and how we, you know, enacted new laws that prevented pollution and things like that. So I don't know who will write that book. Maybe it'll be Monica, I hope, or another great young author that is, you know, 5 years old right now and is just learning how to write. That would be really cool as well.
Maybe Paisley.
Yeah, maybe my daughter. We'll see. I had her out there watering plants and we were putting together cards, and you know, working from home has been really wild with kids. And I brought my 9-month-old baby out to the field yesterday where we were doing an orientation with our new intern team out at a site on the Sammamish River. And of course she falls asleep in the car on the way there and, you know, sleeps like 5 minutes. And I thought, well, she'll have to be crabby and I'll just put her in the carrier. And she actually stayed asleep just sitting there in her car seat outside on the riverbank while we all got to work. So it was cool. But I do in Monica's book, or sorry, in Alexandra's book, where she's talking about having kids and working with kids. And, you know, it talks about she put her son in the front of the Zodiac and just kind of made this like makeshift cover to protect him from the wind, and he'd have his Legos and stuff down there. And, you know, she made it sound like, not that it was easy breezy, but that, you know, it was almost like no problem. And we just made a creative solution and it was great. You know, daycare on the bow. And I have not had similar experiences. You know, I would love to, like, I remember taking my daughter up to Lime Kiln when she was like 2, and it's very rocky, and you just spend all the time looking down to try and make sure they don't like trip over a rock and cut their face open, you know, so you don't even have time to look up to see the whales or put binoculars in your hands to see them. So I was, yeah, really impressed by Alexandra Morton and everything she was able to accomplish. And I think as a mom, you have days where you win and the kid sleeps on the riverbank, and then you have days where you lose and you just can't look up, right?
Right. I think it's a balance. And at least, you know, with your daughters and with Alexandra's kids that she writes about in the book, they got such an amazing wildlife and conservation experience at such a young age. Like what a cool way, what cool moms to have, and what a cool way to grow up and have all of that knowledge and that exposure to like those activities right from the start. Like your daughters are going to be amazing conservationists because they have such a great role model to getting them started at 9 months old.
Thanks. Yeah. Whether they like it or not, you
whether
know,
they like it or not, and whether they remember it or not, it'll
yeah
it'll sink in.
Well, yeah, it is fun. I would love to take them up to like the wilderness, like Alexandra Morton describes, where mm-hmm. she's up in BC and really, and spoiler alert, I'm going to say it. Tragically, her husband dies in this book, and then she is left to really make it on her own. And was a powerful story too, unrelated to the whales perhaps, but it's a really great story and it connected to it a lot.
Yeah, that's, I think, you know, with her book being kind of part memoir and her experiences as a woman researcher in this field that was very male dominated and in an area that's very male dominated too, and how she kind of adapted and made it work and has become this leading researcher for orcas and for salmon issues. It's inspiring to read, and she's become kind of an orca role model for everybody, young girls and young men alike, for research. So kind of shows it's possible. It's possible to make it happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say all these authors are leaders in the orca community. Mm-hmm. Another leader that's mentioned in all three is Dr. Michael Bigg. And, you know, I never had the opportunity to meet him, but everyone who I've talked to has only said just fabulous things about him.
Yeah, it's very cool how he kind of makes appearances in each book. And again, with these different time periods and how his influence and how his role as the initiator of this research and our knowledge about orcas influenced each of these authors and scientists in different ways. But
yeah,
you kind of, I think, can't talk about the orcas and their history without mentioning Michael Bigg and how his work shaped what we know.
And of course, his work pioneered the photo identification of all of these whales, which enabled scientists to understand just how many whales were out there, and so much more, and about their family and social structures, knowing who was who and how they were related. And one thing that really struck with me was that, you know, he was humble and he wasn't afraid to say he didn't know something when he didn't know it. And that he was also open with sharing information.
Yeah.
And really was kind and open and generous. And I think that really sticks with me.
Yeah, same for me. Just his willingness to, again, share that information and work with other researchers and kind of be open to collaboration and trying to answer some of those questions that he didn't know the answers to as a group effort and with a lot of people working together on different pieces.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, are there any other topics that you want to discuss? Any final thoughts that you have to share?
Well, I was going to say, speaking of the research, it also kind of, I noted, we talked about the other common theme of acoustics throughout the books and each of these authors and scientists kind of starting with listening to the whales, kind of metaphorically and literally.
Yeah.
and how it's kind of, I think we talked about it with Monica, that she does have some acoustics work coming up, but the focus has really shifted from the initial, you know, we're just understanding these whale populations and we want to understand their acoustics better and what they're saying and how they're communicating, to more research into threats and why they're struggling to survive. And I think the acoustics kind of got left behind, I guess, in the need to understand how all the threats are interacting for these whales. But I'm really glad that Monica's going to go back to the acoustics, because I think it's such a fascinating question. And what they talk about in all the books is trying to figure out, you know, how they're, what they're saying to each other, you know. And it's just what a cool thing to try to understand is the language of whales and how they're talking to each other and what they're saying.
Yeah, I imagine that once we got a handle on southern residents becoming endangered, then a lot of the research was driven by grant funding that was trying to understand some of these really serious questions of, you know, what they're eating and what's killing them, right? Yeah. What's limiting their survival. So yeah, it is really exciting to hear that we are still able to do some acoustics research. And, you know, there's so much unknown. Maybe we will be able to unlock something that will give us clues to conservation. We just don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I hope that our listeners are inspired to pick up a copy of these books and read them. And, you know, even if we can't be out watching whales right now, that you can explore and go on an adventure through the pages of these books, and do your own listening to whales when you can. You can, of course, log on to the Hydrophone network and do your own listening. It is, as we mentioned, today's June 25th. Southern residents have still not made their return into the inland waters yet. But you might want to switch on those hydrophones and do some listening yourself to hear when they might come, because I know everyone is going to be very excited to see southern residents return to the inland waters this summer. And you can follow us to learn more about how they're doing, of course. Keep an eye out for community discussions July with Eric Hoyt's book, August with Alexandra's book, and September with Monica's book. And we'll post more information about those online.
Yeah, thanks everybody. And, you know, if you're tuning in on the hydrophones, maybe you'll crack the code of what they're saying.
Sure. I hear dog language.
You can crack the code of my dog who just woke up from his nap. So
that sounded like a J-pod call.
He has his own vocalizations.
Yes.
We're trying to figure out.
Oh, that's really funny. So if you want to learn more about the Orca Month, go to orcamonth.com for all those events. You can visit whalescout.org for more podcasts like this. And to learn more about Colleen's work, go to whales.org. Thank you so much for listening today.
Thanks, everybody.